occasions because I didn't want to lose a finger when something caught on my ring while I was at work, was beautiful. The engagement ring had a single large pear-cut diamond. My wedding ring was plainer, just two small yellow topazes, Adam said were the same color as my eyes when I went coyote. The rings had been braised together so that the topazes flanked the diamond. It was the dog tag that turned the necklace from jewelry to statement. The tag hadn't been pretty to start with, and after nearly four decades of wear and tear, it was battered and rough. Adam wore the other tag at all times. Symbols. I closed my hand on Adam's dog tag as the door to the bedroom opened and quietly shut again. Adam's arms came around me, and he bent so he could put his head on my shoulder. There was a mirror on the top of the dresser so I could see his face, and his eyes in the mirror met mine.
"Thank you," he said.
"For what?" He smiled, a peaceful expression that lightened suddenly with mischief.
"For keeping the peace. You don't think that I don't know you could wipe the floor with a lightweight like Christy? You battled with Bran when you were just a kid and came out on top. Christy, she's not a tithe on Bran."
I snorted. "I don't know where you get your information, but I didn't win any battles with our lord and master Bran Cornick, who is the Marrakk. No one does. That's why he's the Marrakk." He snorted back.
"That's not what Bran says."
"Then he's doing it for his own reasons," I told him. "Don't put too much weight on his stated opinion. More than likely, he's just trying to get you to do something you don't want to do."
"Peanut butter," Adam said, deadpan.
"He made my foster mother cry," I said.
"Eggs."
That didn't work so well, I told him, but I did learn not to arm my enemies.
"Shoes."
Shocked, I turned around so I could see his face instead of just the reflection. "No one knows about the shoes. Bran doesn't know." I hadn't thought that Bran knew about the shoes.
"I don't know if Bran does," Adam said. "Samuel said that he and Charles cooperated to keep Bran guessing because he was really enraged about the shoes."
Charles had covered for me? I'd known that Samuel had seen me and not said anything, but I hadn't known about Charles. Truth was that in my heart of hearts, I'd been a lot more scared of Bran's son Charles than I'd ever been scared of Bran. I just never believed that Bran would really hurt me. Charles would do whatever he had to. I was still more scared of Charles than Bran, but not as scared, because Adam had my back. The shoes were not the brightest idea I've ever had, I admitted, but I was provoked. I met Adam's eyes, and we stared at each other for a minute. Then I started to snicker. He laughed and pulled me into his body. I relaxed, and it felt like the first time I'd relaxed since Christy came to stay with us. "The shoes didn't really have anything to do with Bran," I told him.
"Leah is his mate," he said. "Of course it had something to do with Bran, especially when he couldn't figure out who was stealing her shoes."
I laughed again, tried to stop while I said, "Only one shoe."
"One of each pair, at a time. 43 shoes gone over a 5-week period. Sometimes 2 or 3 shoes in the same day. Not a scent trace to be found. Just like a wizard had conjured them away."
I blinked away tears and tried to stop laughing. It wasn't that funny. It was the release of the tension that had been building up for days. I actually can't remember what it was Leah did specifically, but I'm sure it was something worse than making me enemy number one because I let her tablecloth get stained.
"Samuel said Leah put out a bounty on the shoes and the thief."
That sent me off again. "Her face," I managed. If only I had a photograph of her face, though I had a pretty good memory of it. I thought she was just going to spontaneously combust right there in front of us, barefoot.
"When Samuel told me about it, he asked me to find out how you managed it without leaving your scent behind. He said that when he asked you, you told him that you were keeping your secret in case you had to do the same to him someday."
"Fishing pole and a big hook," I told Adam, because I'd do better than shoes if I had to get back at him for something. The hardest part was shutting the closet without going into the room. I thought about it. Okay, the closet door and getting out of the house 40-odd times without getting caught. Thank goodness I spent a lot of legitimate time over at that house, so I didn't have to try to cover up my scent except to keep it out of Bran's bedroom.
What did you do with the shoes? Samuel said Bran searched your foster parents' house for them.
I snickered again. Searched every day, sometimes twice a day, every time a shoe disappeared. Brian got mad about it eventually, but Evelyn thought it was funny. I dumped the shoes in a glacial lake that was about 3 miles from our house. In between trips, because I couldn't quite manage to make it there unseen every day, I hid them in the bed of Charles's truck.
I thought you were afraid of Charles.
I nodded. So was everyone else, though, and he only drove that truck when he absolutely had to.
You said you tossed all of them in the lake. I thought one of those shoes returned a few years later. Where did you hide it?
His eyes were happy. In the lake with the rest. I shivered in reflex. It took me 4 hours of diving in that lake to find a shoe, and that was a glacier-fed lake. Most of the shoes had rotted into mush, but there was a steel stiletto with this wiry mesh stuff that looked pretty good. By that time, Bran had quit looking, so I didn't have to be so careful. Brian and Evelyn had both been dead then, too, and I'd been living alone in their house that no longer really felt like my own. Not even their ghosts had lingered with me. I didn't tell Adam that. He was too perceptive, and I was too prone to self-pity with Christy living on the other side of my bedroom wall. I cleared my throat. I had to work on that stupid shoe for months before it didn't look like it had spent 2 years in water. But her face at the sight of it sitting on top of the Christmas tree was so worth it.
She'd hurt you,
Adam said, his voice soft and certain. She couldn't hurt me, I corrected briskly, if not truthfully. To earn the Christmas tree topper, she'd made a disparaging remark about my foster father, Brian, after he'd killed himself. She made me mad.
She hurt you.
I shrugged. I was pretty sure she'd clean my clock after that one. I mean, even without evidence, who else could it have been?
She couldn't.
Adam's face was satisfied.
Samuel told me that when she tried to bring her case to Bran, Charles swore in front of most of the pack that you were with him all day working on cars during the only time the switch between the star and the shoe could have been made. No one could hear the lie, so she had to leave it or challenge Charles first.
He lied? I said, shocked. Thought about it and said in a hushed voice, he lied? And no one could tell?
It's Charles, Adam explained, as if that was enough.
And it was.
You handled Bran, and you handled Leah. So don't tell me you couldn't put a stop to Christy's taunts and teach her to behave herself until she goes home.
I didn't think it would be as easy as he made it seem, but he was right that I was backing away from a confrontation. If she goes before there's a knockdown, drag-out fight between the pro-me and the pro-Christy factions, it'll be better for the pack. My voice was small.
And less collateral damage, he said, kissing my nose. Jessie has to deal with concerning her mother. She doesn't need more drama. Arielle, Mary Jo, they don't really know who she is. And that's not a bad thing.
She's not a horrible person, I protested. He smiled briefly.
No. She makes people feel good for defending her, for doing things for her. Makes them feel like heroes. She made me feel that way once, too. Nothing wrong with that.
He kissed me.
But I like my women less helpless.
I went limp against him and said dramatically, I'm helpless against your kisses. He laughed like a villain in a cartoon.
Aha, so that's how it's done. Well, there's no help for you then.
No. I said in a faint voice, putting an arm over my forehead as I arched back over his arm in the classic pose of the helpless ingenue. I guess you'll just have your wicked way with me again.
Cool, said my husband, a wicked growl in his voice. Don't worry, you'll enjoy every minute of it.
I finished the Wasserboxer engine I was rebuilding with great satisfaction. As if to make up for the chaos in my own life, the engine was going together as sweet as molasses and twice as easy. Like a gambler on a winning streak, I was worried that I'd ruin it in the last moves, but it buttoned up duck soup, as if I were putting it together in the factory instead of 30 years later. I had an urgent brake job left, brought in about 15 minutes before. However, I decided last night, after Adam was sleeping beside me and looking more relaxed than he'd been in days, that I was finished leaving the battlefield to Christy. That was giving her too much advantage. I'd have the brakes done by lunch tomorrow, and that would have to be soon enough. I patted the Wasserboxer for being such a good patient and stripped out of my overalls in the oversized bathroom laundry room. I got a can of soda from the fridge, and, clad in civilian clothes, I ventured into the main office. Closing time.
Sounds good, Tad said, looking up from the books where he was finishing recording an appointment.
Gabriel had been trying to get me to set up the appointment schedule on computer, but Tad didn't seem to mind the paper route.
You look tired, Mercy. Go home, get something to eat. You look like you've lost 10 pounds.
Maybe I should eat more red velvet cupcakes, I said dryly. I brought 2 this morning, and Tad had eaten them both.
Only if you make sure Christy knows they are for me, or check them for arsenic, he answered, using his keys to make the till run its daily total.
I opened my eyes wide. Oh, shoot, I've just been feeding them to you. Are you feeling ill? I peered anxiously at his lips. I think your lips are turning blue. Do you feel faint?
He grinned at me. Arsenic is a metal, Mercy. Don't you remember your high school chemistry?
Semi-metallic, I told him.
And Dad is iron-kissed, a master of metals.
He tucked his thumbs under his imaginary collar and grinned with lots of cheese.
I'm just a chip off the old block and safe from arsenic attacks of all kinds.
I'll remember that the next time you drive me to attempted murder, I said. I quit joking and sighed. She's going home soon. Then we can get on with our lives, as long as she wasn't serious when she was threatening to move here. I took a good long swig of my soda. It's only a matter of time before Adam finds her stalker and sends him off with the fear of Adam to keep him away from her for the rest of his life. He gave me a half smile, because we both knew that it was a lot more likely that we'd have to kill the man. I should have felt worse about it, but I'd been raised by werewolves, and the bastard had burned down a building full of innocent bystanders. 4 people hadn't gotten out of the apartment building before it collapsed.
I talked to Dial last night about your trouble with Beauclair and Coyote, Tad said unexpectedly. The mirror still isn't a good idea, but the old Fay has a few tricks up his sleeve that none of the Grey Lords know about yet. I told him that you haven't had much luck finding Coyote.
Did he have any advice? I asked. It was unlikely that Z would know how to contact Coyote, but I was ready for any help I could get. Today was Friday. I had 2 days left.
He did, Tad told me. He said that if you hadn't managed anything better by tonight, I was to tell you that you've been overlooking any number of avenues open to you in a way that is very unmercy-like. He smiled. His words.
What am I overlooking? I'd called in all my markers. I'd even called Charles this morning, who had unhelpfully suggested I try a vision quest. Vision quests require fasting, which I could manage, but also a centered focus that I was never going to achieve with Christy in my home. He'd promised to call some shaman priests he knew, but warned me that, as I already knew, Coyote was elusive and mischievous. Searching and calling for Coyote was likely to result in exactly the opposite outcome. Charles had been my last hope.
You've been concentrating on Coyote when you should have been also looking at Beauclair.
Tad held up a finger.
Without you, it is unlikely that Beauclair will ever see the walking stick again, and he knows it.
2 fingers up.
2. That means that you have a bargaining chip, and it also means that Beauclair loses if something happens to you. Daw also said you've been making Beauclair the villain when he is more comfortably the hero. Beauclair is honorable, as Fay understand the word, and he has spent a human lifetime as a lawyer. He'll understand compromise. If you can convince Beauclair that you will sincerely return the walking stick to him when and if you see Coyote, he will probably grant you time to do so. Time, Daw also asked me to remind you, is less precious to a Grey Lord like Beauclair than it is to you.
My jaw didn't drop because I had it locked tight. Tad grinned at me.
He said you'd probably figure it out on your own if you got desperate enough.
Then I told him about Christy, and he gave me permission to talk to you tonight if you hadn't worked it out already. I don't know what expression was on my face, but Tad's gentled.
Don't feel too bad. Don knows Beauclair, and it gives him an advantage. You'll still have to bargain hard and fast and be diplomatic. And Doss said, whatever you do, don't mention his name or all bets are off. Beauclair knew that someone was going to have to take out Lou. He was apparently girding up his loins to do just that when Da took care of it. That didn't mean he didn't swear vengeance.
I shook off my chagrin and gave Tad a fist bump. Thank you. I feel like a lead weight is off my back. I'll keep looking for Coyote, but more time means that I might not be responsible for the Columbia rising up and out of its banks and wiping the Tri-Cities from the face of the earth.
Anytime, he said. My duty's dispatched. I am off to home.
Good luck with Christy, and remind her that we work tomorrow even though it is Saturday, so we'll need something tasty to get us through the day. And you need to start eating, or your plan to pretend she doesn't bother you will be revealed to anyone who looks at your ribs. I locked up after Tad and set Adam's security system, Tad's last words ringing in my ears. I started to get my purse out of the safe when I stopped and went back into the bathroom and peered into the mirror. I looked just like me. Native American coloring, mostly Caucasian features inherited from my mother. Except now that I knew to look at them, the shape of my eyes was like Gary Laughing Dog's. I tried to visualize Coyote's face, but I didn't know if I was imagining that his eyes were the same or not. My hair was in the braids I usually wore to work in order to keep it out of the way so it didn't get covered in grease when I pushed it out of my face. And Tad was right. My features were sharper. There was no question that not eating the food Christy made was making me lose weight. There was still a brake job I could do tonight. If I stretched it out, I'd miss dinner. That would give me an excuse to pick up some high-calorie fast food on the way home, food that didn't taste or smell of Christy. I didn't want Adam to notice I was losing weight because it would hurt him. My husband took care of the people around him. I didn't want Christy to notice because she'd know she was getting to me. I put my overalls back on, pulled on the sweat-inducing gloves, and hoisted the 94 Passat up on the lift so I could pull the back tires and take a look. I was working on compressing the caliper, and had just got this six-sided dice, also known as a piston tool but only at auto parts stores, to engage the caliper when my phone rang. I'd set my phone on a nearby counter, so I didn't have to let go of anything to check the display. Adam. 3 days ago, I'd have answered immediately. But the day before yesterday, it had been Christy asking me to pick up a dozen apples and some butter. Real butter, no salt. Make sure not to get the salted version because everyone eats too much salt. Not a big deal at all. Stopping at the grocery store before I came home wasn't a problem. Having Christy ask me to do it was a different matter. Pack is all about hierarchy. I understood how it works, even if before marrying Adam, I had been on the outside looking in. Humans have hierarchy, too. What Christy had done was the equivalent of the new higher office girl calling the CEO and asking him to bring coffee for the break room, and she'd done it in front of Adam and the four attending wolves. If they hadn't known about it before, they would have known about it afterward. Pack hierarchy was one of those things I'd agreed to deal with when I married Adam, so I paid attention to make his life easier. I couldn't do much about Christy's faux pas without looking like a jealous, arrogant bitch while Christy graciously apologized because she hadn't realized what it was she had done, though she'd lived with a pack for years. So I'd filled her order, then brought 2 dozen Spudnut donuts for the pack. Spudnuts is a Tri-Cities tradition. They make their donuts with potato flour instead of wheat. I might have lost hierarchy points, but Spudnut Donuts bought me credit with the wolves who were at home. The wolves doubtless knew I'd done it to buy their favor. That didn't mean it didn't work. Even Christy couldn't help but eat one. Maybe I should bring them home every day, and that nicely rounded figure would just be rounded. Dreams of petty revenge aside, she'd succeeded in making me paranoid to the point that Adam's cell number on my phone's display made me wary instead of happy. Four rings sounded before I gave in and answered. If it was Christy, I'd just say no to whatever she asked, because I had to work late. This is Mercy, I said neutrally, bracing myself.
Aren't you supposed to be getting home sometime soon?
It was Adam. I relaxed and felt my expression soften.
You've had the security system on for an hour, so I expected you home by now. But I see you are working still.
I waved at the corner where the tiny camera was watching my every move. The cameras downloaded themselves onto Adam's laptop as well as a backup at his office. The interior cameras ran all day long. The exterior cameras in the parking lot and around the outside of the building only turned on when I switched on the nighttime security. Hey, handsome. Just finishing up a break job. Don't wait dinner. I'll grab something on the way home.
Tad's with you, he said smoothly.
If he was watching his feeds, then he knew the answer, and that I'd broken my promise not to work alone and make myself a target to anyone looking to hurt Adam or the pack. I cleared my throat. Sorry, I got distracted. I'll clean up and head home. I expected him to be unhappy with me again, as he'd been when Christy had tried to get me in trouble for going off alone. I should have thought about safety when I'd made my sudden decision to stay and work. I knew it wasn't just me at risk, but the whole pack threw me because I could be used as a hostage.
If you need a night off, he said, sounding sympathetic instead of angry, you could go keep Kyle company. Warren is on guard duty over here tonight. Zach does fine as long as Warren is there because Warren isn't exactly flaming. But he says he can tell from what Zach doesn't say that when it's only Kyle and Zach there, it's pretty awkward.
I read between the lines that Kyle was giving Zach a hard time without Warren there to make sure he behaved. Like a kid in a candy shop, Kyle really enjoyed making people squirm. It was part of what made him such a good lawyer. I have no intention of deserting you for the night, I told him firmly. Kyle and Zach will just have to manage. Kyle is good at that sort of social stuff when he wants to be. I'll be home in a half hour.
Get food first, he said. You need to eat, and I can see why you might have trouble eating here. I'll see you home in an hour or an hour and a half.
I love you, I said with feeling.
Of course you do,
he agreed with a nonchalance that made me grin as he disconnected. I let the car down and put jack stands under the rear axle. The hoist had a very slow leak that didn't matter when someone was there to raise it periodically, but overnight it would lower itself until the car was on the ground. I probably ought to get it fixed, but the garage was barely eking along in the black for once, and I was reluctant to dump it back in the red. A blip on the monitor on the wall between the garage and the office attracted my attention as the outside security cameras switched from daylight-colored to nighttime black and white. The monitor sat on a shelf on top of a rectangular computer box big enough to look serious, though it and the monitor were mostly there so that anyone breaking in would think that was the whole of the security system, and after trashing the system, would quit worrying about the cameras. No, I didn't need a system that sophisticated to watch over my garage, where I repaired cars with sticker prices usually a lot less than the security Adam had installed. But Adam worried, and it cost me less than nothing to let him update the system every few months. I stripped out of my overalls in the bathroom for a second time that day. I paused by the mirror, sighed, and washed my face, because while the gloves worked fine for hands, they still transferred grease to my cheek and mouth. I wished I could get rid of the smell of my job as easily as I scrubbed the black smudges off my face. Christy couldn't smell it, but the werewolves all could. Christy wore some kind of subtle perfume that smelled good to werewolf noses, and mine, too. Apparently Adam had found it for her while they were still married, and she still wore it, or at least she was wearing it while she was here. I left the bathroom and reached out to hit the lights when, in the security monitor, I saw a nearly new Chevy Malibu pull into the parking lot in front of the office. I wouldn't have been alarmed. People can be optimistic about finding mechanics for cars that just have to be ready for a trip at 5 a.m. tomorrow, except that there was a big dog in the back seat. It wouldn't hurt to err on the side of safety. I reached for my phone. "Hello," said Christy cheerily. "Adam's phone. Get at him, I said, watching the lights on the Chevy turn off as he parked the car. There was a bumper sticker advertising a rental car chain on the back of it. I'm afraid. You should be, I told her in a low voice. Hungry and tired from the long hours I'd put in, I was abruptly sick of her stupid games and ready to quit playing. Get at him, now. Don't snap at me, Christy said, all cheer gone. You don't get to order me around, Mercy. You haven't earned the right. The man who opened the driver's door didn't look like someone to be afraid of. He was wearing expensive clothes and slick-soled shoes. But the dog he let out of the back seat more than made up for his owner's civilized appearance. The dog looked like the photos I'd seen of the Presa Canario, but in my parking lot it seemed bigger and nastier, a male with a broad face and broader chest. Lucia had said that people trim their ears to make them look fiercer, but no one needed to make this dog scarier. The dog was just a dog, though. No matter how big and fierce a dog was, after running around with werewolves, no dog scared me. So there was no reason really for me to be afraid of them, a man and his dog. But I was. The image of the dead bodies on the edge of the hayfield in Finley insisted on making itself present, and I tried to shove it off to the side. The worst of the fear, I thought, was because I'd been raped here in my garage, and I no longer ever really felt safe here. Security system or not. Christy's ex-boyfriend was no one to be underestimated, but he was human, and I had a gun readily available. The chill of fear that slid down my spine was unimpressed by logic. In my ear, Christy was nattering away about manners and me being jealous for no reason. Christy, I interrupted her, and let menace color my voice because I refused to let her hear the fear. If you don't give Adam the phone right the hell now, so help me, I will put you out with the rest of the trash in the morning. From the speaker on my cell phone, I could hear some shocked exclamations. Apparently there were some other werewolves in the room when Christy answered, and they'd overheard me threaten her. I'd probably care about that later.
I won't stay where I'm not wanted, she said tearfully. Not even in the home that was mine before,
she squeaked. And her voice cut out, replaced by Adam's.
Mercy.
His voice was very calm, that people are going to die calm only he could do. As soon as he started to speak, silence fell behind him, because I wasn't the only one who knew that voice.
I see him on the camera. You stay right there, don't make any noise, and hopefully he won't be sure you are in there. I'm on my way. Sit tight and don't let him in. I'm going to hang up right now and call the police and Tad.
Adam was 15 minutes out, but Tad was only 5. What could happen in 5 minutes? 7. I didn't carry at work. With Tad there, there was no reason, and a gun just got in the way while I was squirming around in engine compartments and under cars. My carry gun, the 9mm, was locked in the safe with my purse. I wasn't going into the office to open the safe, because the office had big picture windows, and someone who had burned down a building that housed dozens of innocent people wouldn't hesitate to break a few windows. Paranoia meant I had a second gun tucked in a special lockbox attached to the underside of the counter nearest the office. My fingers pressed the code, and a half-second later I had the cool and heavy Model 629 Smith & Wesson 44 Magnum in my hand. I wasn't Dirty Harry, but I'd shot my foster father's Model 29 since I was big enough to handle it. My foster father's 44 was in the gun safe at home, but the only difference between it and the 629 was that the 629 was stainless steel. Both of them were too heavy for me to shoot for more than a few rounds, but I could hit a pretty tight pattern on a target at 50 feet with a gun as long as it was in the first 12 shots. The gun was Adam's, and he'd suggested I get another Sig Sauer 9mm like my preferred gun instead, because it was lighter, and being an automatic, the 9mm was faster to reload. I told him it was a waste of money when he already had this one. I had made the assumption that this guy was Christy's stalker and not some poor lost traveler who stopped to use the phone or something. We hadn't managed to get any kind of photo of him, But how many guys travel in rental cars with a wicked-looking dog? I looked at the monitor again and tried to evaluate him in the black-and-white screen. He appeared to be tallish, and his hair was light-colored. Without anything that eliminated him from the description Christy had given, I decided I was okay with making the assumption that he was the bad guy. If not, I could apologize to him later. Why had he come here instead of going after Christy? Maybe he had, and all the people we had guarding her had made him rethink his plan. Maybe he thought he could take me to use as leverage to get to Christy. Or if he was really crazy, and burning down a building was acting crazy in my book, he might be planning on killing me to get back at Adam for keeping Christy from him. Maybe he just wanted to ask me if I'd seen Christy. My understanding of psycho stalkers was not infallible. It was also very possible that I was overreacting. My chest hurt, and I felt the stupid lightheadedness that told me I was flirting with a full-blown panic attack. Panic attacks were stupid and counterproductive, rendering me helpless to protect myself until they were over. Happily, I didn't have them as often as I used to, but now was not the time. I reminded myself firmly that I had prepared for another attempted assault. I had a bolt hole for the coyote to hide in. At the back of the garage, on the top of the floor-to-ceiling shelves, there was an old wooden box, a fake box. The front and most of one side were all that was left. Those I had wood glued and screwed to the shelf so it wouldn't fall off if I bumped it. A narrow opening at the back of the side, not against the wall, meant I could squeeze into the box, but I wasn't trapped because the box had no lid. All the way up near the roof of my 14-foot-high garage meant it didn't need a top to keep me hidden, and I had about a foot between the top of the box and the ceiling. So why wasn't I doing the smart thing and hiding up there as a coyote? He might know who I was and where I worked, but it was extremely unlikely that he knew what I was. I watched the monitors as he tried the door, then looked around the parking lot. The camera angle wasn't wide enough for me to see what he was looking at, but I was pretty sure it was my van. He couldn't know I was still there unless he'd been watching the shop, but the van might make him suspicious. That was assuming he knew what I drove, which might be giving him too much credit. Though he had apparently followed Christy from Eugene, and I knew that Adam wouldn't have advertised the trip over here if he could help it. He'd figured out she was staying with us and found my garage. It wasn't too much to assume he knew what I drove. He walked away from the door and back to his car, the big dog pacing at his side without a leash, just as Lucia's dog had done. I had time to hide. The security camera had its eye focused on me, recording my every move. If I hid from this human, the whole pack would know what I had done. Christy was human, fragile, and no longer the Alpha's wife. That she had gotten into trouble she couldn't get out of by herself was to be expected. In a wolf pack, the dominant members protect. They don't need protection. I was not just the Alpha's wife. I was his mate and a pack member. That all meant that what I did mattered, and I was expected to make a better showing than Adam's fragile ex-wife who'd driven this man off with nothing more than a frying pan. So I stood watching the monitors, waiting for him to break in, instead of hiding in safety. But the knowledge I chose to face him, that I had other options, seemed to have pushed the panic attack away. I watched as Christy's stalker walked back over and began working on the front door of my garage. Darkness hadn't yet fallen, though the sun was low in the sky. 5 minutes until help arrived. 5 minutes if Tad was at home when Adam called him. If not, Adam would be here in 15. What did it say about Christy's stalker that he risked breaking into my garage with a crowbar when it was still light out? Was he stupid? Or did he think he had enough money, enough power, to escape the consequences of his actions? I closed my eyes and stretched my neck and rolled my shoulders to loosen them. The front door gave with a tremendous crack, but my ears are more sensitive than most. I leaned on the front of the Passat and left the gun resting on the hood, though I kept my hold on it. Lifting the gun up too soon would cause my arms to tire and I'd lose accuracy. I didn't worry that he would be too fast, because I was as quick as any of the werewolves, and they were a lot faster than any human. It was probably only seconds between the time he broke down the door and when he came into the garage bay, but it seemed like hours. I spent the time reminding myself that I wasn't drugged up on some fey magic concoction that prevented me from disobeying orders, that Tad was coming, that Adam was on his way, that if I shot him, then Christy would have to leave. I've killed people before. If I felt like I had a choice, I wouldn't have killed them. No choice meant I had no regrets for those kills. Maybe I should have felt worse about that. Maybe it was being a walker, or maybe being a predator. I didn't think it would bother me to kill this man who had killed 4 innocent people, 5 if you counted the man who dated Christy a couple of times. Even so, I wasn't going to shoot him unless he made me do it, I told myself sternly. Not even if it meant getting Christy out of my home. I concentrated on keeping my expression cool, and when he stepped into the light, I said, "Mr. Flores, I presume?" He stopped, and the big dog stopped too, his shoulder precisely at his master's leg. The dog's gaze was alert, intelligent, and primal. Ancient. I blinked, and the dog was just a dog. My first impression was probably a product of the stress of the moment, an accident of shadows. Flores smiled and raised both hands to his shoulder height, palms out, dropping the crowbar as he did so. I flinched a little at the noise of the crowbar hitting the floor.
"I see that you were expecting me, Mrs. Hauptmann."
He glanced at the monitors, and his smile widened.
"I am not here to hurt you or yours, but your husband has something that belongs to me, and I want it back."
Looking at his face under the light, and I knew why Christy had climbed right into bed with him. If Adam was movie star handsome, this man was porn star material. Eyes so dark blue they could only come from contacts, skin either tanned or naturally Mediterranean dark, and even, well-defined features with sensual overtones. Bright gold hair, whitened in streaks by the sun or a skilled hairdresser, swept back from his face in an expensive cut. But the most noticeable thing about him, the thing that Christy had never described, was the air of sexuality that he brought with him. No one would look at this man and not think male, sex, and dangerous. "Christy appealed to us for protection from you," I told him steadily. "If you know where she ran, if you know where I work, then you know what Adam is. We granted her protection, Adam and I and the whole pack. She doesn't belong to you. She belongs to us. She never belonged to you. You need to leave. If you leave right now, my mate won't kill you where you stand."
"I don't want to cause trouble," he said, and he lied.
His dog took a step forward. I had the big gun out and aimed before the dog took another step. "I might regret shooting the dog, but I won't hesitate," I told Flores. He did something with his hand, and the big dog stepped back. The air conditioning kicked in, and the air blew past them into my nose, bringing with it the faint scent of magic. A faint scent that altered everything, because I'd smelled that scent yesterday while I stared at a dead woman in a hayfield. I fought to keep my expression from changing and angled my face a little to the camera. "You caused a lot of trouble in Finley," I said, knowing the powerful little lens would catch my lips. Someone would figure out what I had said, because there was not a chance in hell that I was coming out of this alive unless Tad or Adam made it here in time. "I saw what you did. Enjoy horse meat, do you?" A puzzled look crossed his face, as if he were going to deny knowing what I was talking about. And then he smiled. His body language changed as he straightened, like an actor shedding a role. He licked his lips.
"Horse meat is not my first choice, no, but it sufficed at the time."
He liked to talk with his hands.
"He understands the message I left in that field, your husband, does he not? I do not recognize his territory, and I hunt freely therein. He has taken she who is mine, So I shall take from him she who is his. Balance. Only then will I take his life, and that is vengeance. There is no one safe from my... I shot the dog. A clean killing shot to his head. He dropped without a sound. Alive one moment, dead the next. Floris staggered back a few steps, clutching his chest, almost as if I'd shot him there, instead of his dog. He twisted to look at the dog, then turned to me, crouching a little with rage in his face.
You dare!
Your fault, I said coolly, aiming steadily at him and not looking at the poor dog. You signaled, and he gathered himself for attack. I warned you.
My children are immortal, he told me in a breathless hiss,
and with theatrics that belonged on stage rather than in the mundane environment of my garage. Christie had been right. There was something European in his accent, but not anything I'd heard before. Vaguely Latinish, maybe, but not any Hispanic accent I was familiar with. The accent added melodrama to his already melodramatic words.
Tied to flesh that can be killed, but that mortal flesh is easily replaced. My son will not die but rise again, and so your efforts to defeat me and mine fail. Even so, you will suffer for this before you die.
Your children are immortal? I asked, repeating the important part of his words for the camera to catch. The first security system had had sound, but when Adam had updated, he traded sound for better video. Tied to mortal flesh. Who are you?
Coyota, he said.
Coyote? I asked, and I know my eyes widened. He wasn't coyote.
Coyota, he said again.
And I heard once more the odd pronunciation that Gary Laughing Dog had used in the middle of his vision. Not coyote with a weird accent, but another name altogether. With a G, I said. But Flores, who called himself Coyota, was done listening to me.
Your husband thinks to keep the son from me, he said. He will regret it.
Something happened. Something that smelled of scorched fabric and magic. I cried out as that heat seared my cheek. But even as the pain made my eyes water, I shot. I aimed at Floris's face, and I kept firing until the bullets were gone. Holes appeared in his face as I shot, two side by side in the middle of his forehead, one in his cheekbone. Then I switched targets, and two more holes opened up around his heart, the final one a little low and right. Out of bullets, I grabbed a big wrench and made a backward hop onto the hood of the Passat. It rocked a little under my weight, and I thought that I'd have to remember to tell the owner that it needed work on the shocks, too. Another hop put me on the roof of the car and gave me a little space. The bullets had knocked Floris back. He hit a rack of miscellaneous parts and sent it crashing to the floor. Floris bounced off the rack, almost followed it to the ground, but caught his balance at the last instant. I felt a cold chill, because with three bullets in his face and two in the chest, he caught his balance and stayed on his feet. A funny sound filled the garage. It made my throat hurt and buzzed my ears. He was laughing. A cold, hard knot in my belly told me that probably someone else was going to have to deal with the shocks on the Passat. My shoes were soft-soled, and so had no trouble sticking to the top of the Passat. The gun was of no more use except as a club, but I kept it in my left hand and kept the wrench in my right. I didn't have much of a chance, but that didn't mean I was going to roll over and give the thing my throat. Adam was coming, and the camera was rolling. Even assuming he killed me, the longer I held out, the more information they'd glean from the recording. Floris's face changed as he laughed, flowing and darkening. But beneath the darkness, visible in cracks in his skin, was a sullen red light. My changes are almost instantaneous. The werewolves take a lot longer than that, with the exception of Charles. But none of us glowed. Floris, Coyota, moved his hand, still laughing, and something flew at me. I dodged, but it slid over my shirt, which caught fire, and landed on top of the Passat. A quick brush of my hands put my shirt out,
leaving me with blisters on the skin along my collarbone and a hole in my bra strap. I slid back one step to see what he'd thrown at me without having to look away from him. It was about the size of a finger, blackened and oozing on one end. I chanced a quick glance and realized that not only was it the size of a finger, it had a fingernail. I almost nudged it with my foot to be sure, but the paint was blackening and bubbling up around it, and directly underneath it, the metal was sagging. I'd read an account written by a Civil War commander about how he'd seen the cannonball coming toward one of his men who was wounded and down. It had been coming so slowly, and he'd just reached down to deflect it, and had lost his arm. I didn't touch it. Guayota had a distance weapon, however weirdly horrible, and that meant keeping back from him was no good. Time enough later to wonder at the finger and how he'd made it so hot it could melt the roof of the car, for now I had to concentrate on survival. Nor could I follow my sensei's first rule of fighting. He who is smart and runs away lives to fight another day. The bay doors were closed, and I had no way to run. Out of other options, I attacked. There had been no more than a fraction of a second between when he threw the finger and when I jumped off the car. His burning finger meant that I knew better than to touch him with my skin. The wrench I'd grabbed was a giant size 32mm. It weighed about 3 pounds and gave me almost 2 feet of additional reach. I got 4 hits on him, 3 with the wrench and 1 with the gun, and in that time, I learned a lot about him. He wasn't used to his prey knowing how to fight back. He had never been trained to fight hand to hand. He was slower than I was. Not much slower, but it was enough for me to get in 4 hits. He was oddly sticky, and I lost the gun to him when it sank into his flesh to be quickly consumed and absorbed. And finally, nothing I tried seemed to hurt him. He continued to heat up as we fought, and before I got the next hit in, his clothes flared up in a wall of flames, then drifted to ashes. His face had melted into something with eyes and a mouth, but no other features that I could pick out in the wavy blackness of his skin. Other than his face, his body remained in other ways human-like, but there was nothing human about his skin. It was char-black and formed into a bumpy, almost bark-like surface. Fissures broke open as he moved, revealing, as I'd noticed before, something deep orange with red overtones. His outer surface reminded me of nothing so much as film I'd seen of the active lava flows in Hawaii. He touched me, a glancing blow on my hip. I slapped my hip to put out the fire, and refused to look, because although my face still hurt, as did the skin across my collarbone, my hip had just gone numb. My 5th hit landed in one of those odd fissures in his skin, this one on his left shoulder blade, or at least where a shoulder blade would have been had he been human. It knocked him forward. He wasn't immune to the laws of physics. My arm and hand were spattered by hot chunks of liquid that burned. Remembering the finger that sank into metal, I knocked the hot splatters off me, but the skin beneath them bubbled up into blisters that hurt. Floris reached out, a longer reach than he should have been able to manage, and grabbed hold of the end of my wrench. Where he touched, the metal glowed orange, and the glow rapidly spread toward my hand. I let go of the wrench before the glow touched my skin. The air was smoky now, and not just with burning fabric. All sorts of flammable liquids spill on the floor of a garage. Although I clean them by pouring on cat litter or hypersorb and sweep them up, there was enough residue here and there to react as he brushed past them, so that there were several small fires burning reluctantly on the cement. I spent an anxious and weaponless few moments just getting out of the way of his jabs and kicks before I could get close to something else I could use as a weapon. I tripped over the crowbar he'd dropped, but didn't pick it up. It was all metal, and I just learned that I wanted something that didn't transfer heat as well as metal did. But when I tripped, I knocked the big mop over on myself and grabbed it as I rolled to my feet. The big wooden mop handle made an okay bow staff, and I used it to keep him from approaching me while occupying him seriously enough that he couldn't rip off another finger or other body part to throw at me. The wood kept catching fire, but if I swung it fast enough, The air put the flames out before it could burn much away. It was getting rapidly shorter, but I was only using the very end to poke him rather than using it like a baseball bat. I managed to lure him into leading with the top half of his body and hit him in the middle of his forehead with the end of the mop handle in a lunge that would have done a fencing master proud. The wood sank a good 4 inches into his forehead and stuck there. When he jerked away, he took the mop handle with him. He wrenched it out and threw his head back and howled, a noise so high-pitched that it made my ears hurt. He bent double, and parts of his body stuck together, melting or melding. I took a chance and sprinted to one of my big toolboxes and grabbed a 3-foot-long crowbar off the top. This crowbar had a big red rubber handle to protect my hands. I was running back across the garage, crowbar held up and over my shoulder, when something really big flew past me. Something large enough that the air disturbance in its wake fluttered my shirt as it passed. It hit Guayota right in his center mass, scooped him off his feet, and carried him back 5 or 6 feet in the air before he hit the far wall and the floor at the same time. That wall was covered with a plethora of rubber hoses and belts hung in a semi-organized fashion. He set the ones he touched on fire, and a new wave of toxic smoke filled the air as the thing that hit him fell to the ground with a dull smack that resolved itself into the motor from a 62 Beetle that I'd had sitting in the office to be taken for scrap. Adam was here. A Beetle motor isn't huge as motors go, but it still weighed over 200 pounds. Even I don't know all that many people who can fling an engine as if it were a baseball. But I didn't look for him because, surprise, surprise, not even being hit by 200 pounds had put Guayota out of the game. He rose from the ground, covered in flaming belts and hoses that he shed as he moved. He was no longer even vaguely human-like. Instead, he had the form of a huge dog shaped much like the dog I'd shot. His head was broad and short-muzzled, and his ears hung down like a hunting dog's. His mouth was open, revealing big, sharp teeth of the many, many category. The creature he'd turned into was bigger and heavier than any werewolf I'd ever seen. This was the beast that had feasted on horses, dogs, and women next to that hayfield in Finley.
"Mercy is mine," Adam said softly from somewhere just behind me. "You need to leave here, right now."
"Yours?" The voice was still Floris's, though liquid splattered from the dog-like monster's mouth to sizzle on the floor as he talked.
"You took she who is mine. It is only meet that I take she who is yours." "Christy Hauptmann is the mother of my daughter," Adam said, "and I loved her once. She cared for me for years, and that gives her the right to ask me for protection from someone who frightens her. You have no right to her, no right to be here at all."
The dog, who had been Floris, who was evidently the Guayota my half-brother had warned me about, stopped and tilted his head. The dog's skin looked like it had when it was a human shape wearing it. On the dog, the charred, blackened crust resembled fur. Fur that dripped molten and glowing bits of stuff onto the cement floor.
"No," Guayota said, his voice an odd whispering hum that was almost soothing to listen to. "You are wrong. I found my love who had been taken from me, and I celebrated the sun's countenance, warmth and beauty. I gave her all that I was, all that I had been, all that I could be."
The hum rose to a hiss, and I shivered despite the heat, because there was something horrible in that sound. It mutated into a howl that made my bones vibrate like wind chimes. The sound stopped abruptly, but I could feel the air pressure build up, as if we were in an airplane climbing too rapidly.
"Then she left."
He sounded like the man who'd first come into the garage, almost human, sad, but that didn't last.
"She left me when I swore that would never happen again, swore that never, once I finally found her,
would I let her leave me?
That's not a choice you get to make, said Adam. You are scaring her, and you need to leave her alone. I and my pack are sworn to defend her from danger. You don't want to put yourself in my path, Loras.
I tremble, Guayota said, smiling, his teeth white in the red heat of his mouth. See?
A low groaning noise rumbled through the garage, and the floor rocked beneath me, making me stumble awkwardly to keep my feet. The cement floor cracked, and I could hear a crash of epic proportion as the earthquake sent one of the lighter weight racks in the office area over in a crash of miscellaneous VW parts. Guayota laughed, and didn't sound even vaguely human this time.
We all tremble witnessing the might of the Alpha of Werewolves.
There was a popping sound, and steam escaped from one of the fissures in his back. Red glop dropped from his half-open mouth like slobber, but slobber didn't hit cement and score it. Adam scooped up the Wasserboxer engine I just put together and threw it. The Wasserboxer engine is a lot heavier than the old Beetle engine had been, and he threw it more at bowling ball speed than baseball. Guayota rose on his hind legs to meet the engine when it hit, and this time it only pushed him back 2 or 3 feet, and he stayed upright and in control of the slide. Like my gun and the mop handle, the engine sank into him and stuck there, metal glowing. Then I felt a wave of fey magic, and the engine became a shining silver skin that flowed swiftly over whatever Floris had become and covered him entirely before he had a chance to move. "Zee?" I asked, coughing as the acrid smoke of the garage finally became too strong to ignore. I kept my eye on Guayota, but the fey-struck aluminum of the engine block seemed to be capable of staying solid around a creature who had melted hardened steel. The metal flexed a bit before settling into a motionless shape approximately the size of the creature Guayota had become. Within the shiny skin, Guayota made no sound. My science background wasn't all that strong, but I was pretty sure the only thing keeping the aluminum from melting was fey magic.
"Nope, just me," Tad called, his voice a little strained. "Nice throw, Adam."
"Thanks," Adam said, sounding a little breathless himself.
Tad walked out from behind Adam, and he looked a little odd. The stick-out ears that had always given him an almost comical appearance were now pointed, the bones of his face subtly rearranged to beauty as real and as human as Adam's. His eyes were not human at all, polished silver with a cat's-eye pupil of purple. He was a little taller than usual, a little buffer, a little more graceful, and a lot scarier. I wasn't used to thinking of Tad as being scary. I opened my mouth to thank them both, but all I did was cough. I trotted to the garage controls to raise the garage bay doors to let the smoke out and some fresh air in. Adam grabbed the fire extinguisher off the wall and started putting out fires. Both Adam and I were choking on the foul smoke, but Tad seemed to be unaffected by it. As the adrenaline faded, pain took over. I'd evidently hit my right knee on something, and my cheek felt like it was, figuratively I hoped, on fire. Despite my fears, my hip was fine, just a bit achy. There was a hole burned through my jeans and underwear, but the skin beneath looked okay. The burns on my arm, hand, and collarbone hurt like fiends. Sirens sounded in the distance, either police summoned by Adam or the fire department summoned by someone who saw all the smoke. I put my hands on my hips, standing just outside to stay out of the smoke. "You guys better have some explanation for coming in just when I'm about to wipe the floor with him and stealing my victory." Adam smiled, but his eyes were dark as he finished putting out the last fire. He set the fire extinguisher on the floor and stalked over to me.
"Complain, complain, that's all I get. Aren't you the least bit happy to see me?"
I stepped into his arms, turning my head so the wine-dark silk shirt he wore pressed against my unhurt cheek, and twisting so only the unburnt part of my collarbone touched him.
"I thought this was it," I confessed in a whisper,
and his arms tightened on me until I had to tap on his arm.
Too tight, too tight, too tight. Better.
How long can you hold him? Adam asked Tad, though his arms didn't slacken.
Longer than you can hold her, Tad said dryly. He quit struggling, probably lack of air.